From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Perhaps you've grown used to ads following you around the internet. You know, say when you search for a pair of shoes and suddenly ads for those shoes are on every website you visit. Well, would you feel so nonchalant about it if the ads were for political campaigns? Well, that's happening. So-called campaign tech is becoming so sophisticated, campaigns can collect data on you and send you targeted content across all your devices. It might be great for the campaigns, but is it good for democracy? This hour on Point, campaign tech. It's targeting your phone, your TV, your computer, and you. And you can join us. Technology is here to stay. There's no fighting that. But are you comfortable with what it can do and how it influences our elections? Are you okay with campaigns buying your data, what you watch on TV, who your social media friends are, where you go? Should candidates for office be hacking individual voters, or should they be making their cases in the open marketplace of ideas? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio as well. Well, joining us first today from Washington is Evan Halper. He's a staff writer covering politics for the Los Angeles Times. He recently wrote about campaign tech in a story headlined, "Your phone and TV are tracking you and political campaigns are listening in." We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Evan Halper, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so this is so fascinating here. I was wondering if you could actually start by giving us an example, the example you open your story with about how this campaign tech works. You talked about a Wisconsin State Democratic Party meeting. What happened there?
Well, there was a Wisconsin State Democratic Party meeting, and I should preface this by saying that this is what happened there is fairly common. It happens probably every week in politics now, but most voters don't know it. And Tony Evers was running for governor. It was a crowded primary field. And one of the things that he wanted to do was be able to influence everyone in the room there. And so you do all the usual things you do when you go to a party meeting. You know, you shake hands, you network, you work the room. What some of the officials there may not have realized is that the other thing that Tony Evers and maybe others who were there also were doing was putting a digital fence around them. It's called building a geofence. It's something that's been going on in politics for a little while now. And you build that digital fence around everyone in the room, and then you can not only target ads at their phones while they're there, but then you can track and follow them home and follow them home with all these ads that you can send to their phones and other devices. Because what happens inside this geofence is that it picks up the digital IDs of everybody who is in the room or inside the boundaries of that fence. And then that can be used using this cross-device technology to sort of track down their other devices and very narrowly target them with these ads.
Well, so just to underscore here, just by being in the room, everyone who had a phone on them or a digital device of some kind, the unique identification number of those devices was gathered up, scooped up by the campaign or by a company contracted by the campaign. And once they had those IDs, that's what allowed the campaign into the digital lives of everyone who had been in the room, whether they wanted it or not.
That's exactly right. And what these campaigns will say is it's more anonymous than that, that it's these data brokers that scoop up all the digital IDs. So the campaign never has your exact phone number. The data broker has all that information. But you go to the data broker and say, I want to target everybody who was in this room, and I want to keep sending them ads, and I want to target them this way, or I want to target everyone who is in this room who is under 35, and they'll know that, or everyone in this room who may live in a certain geographic area, and they often know that also, or everyone in this room who was in this room and then went to a gun range sometime in the last month, and they may even know that. This tracking is, as you've said, it's very pervasive. And they can use that to find you. Even if they don't know your exact name, they have your digital ID number, and they track down the people they want to target with that.
So how pervasive is it? I mean, how deep does this go? Once they have, say, the unique identification number of your smartphone, and you're going around to all these places, when you go home and your smartphone connects, if you have Wi-Fi at home, connects to your Wi-Fi there, does that give the campaign access to all the other devices in your house too?
It seems to, yeah. Okay. I mean, the technology is a little bit vague, and these companies that do that, when you ask them, okay, so how exactly does this work? Sometimes they'll explain to you, down to detail. Sometimes they say, look, we have 38 different data points, and we're getting this data from all these different data brokers. But what we've seen is that oftentimes one data source will sort of dry up. There'll be, you know, the regulators may decide that this is something they're not comfortable with if the phone companies were giving out certain data, and then they'll say, okay, we're not doing that anymore. And then some journalists will come along, as Motherboard did recently, and be able to find, no, actually, we wanted to track down someone exactly where they were using their cell phone, you know, in a building down to the floor and room they were in. And we were able to do that entirely using data, you know, paying one of these companies $300 and not having any more information. So, you know, what we're finding is whether it's through apps or whether it's through the way you're connecting to the Wi-Fi signal, you know, or some other piece of data that you've given up along the way and not realized it, there's just an immense amount of data on everyone who's using a phone or a laptop or, you know, any of these devices or a smart TV. And that's being used by political campaigns to track you.
Okay, so you mentioned smart TVs there. Tell us a little bit more about that, because, you know, are we now just well past the era where everyone sees roughly the same ads? Because through your smart TV, people can have ads targeted to them in the television content they watch?
That's right. And I think people who are using smart TVs often are not aware of this. This started with satellite TV, actually. In the last election cycle, it became a sort of a popular use of satellite TV where the companies could say, look, we can help a political campaign target down to individual televisions. If you want to find everyone who's between age 35 and 40 or everyone who fits a certain profile, you know, any one of the profiles we talked about before that matches up with the data the satellite company has on you, they were sending individual ads down to your boxes. Now, what's happening now is that the smart TVs are giving out all kinds of new information about you that you may not realize when you go and set up one of these smart TVs, because these privacy policies are so opaque and you just want the smart TV to do the things you bought the smart TV to do. And when you set it up to do those things, you're authorizing it to tell data brokers every show you're watching. And then what happens with that information is it then goes back and the campaign can then find, okay, we want to find everyone who watched, you know, Rachel Maddow last night, and we want to run an ad that either, you know, supports the position that came up on that show or you know, is counter-programming to it. And we want to find all those people. And even if they're not watching Rachel Maddow tonight, you can find all those people thanks to the data that the smart TV gives up and, you know, find them with whatever they're watching the next time they turn on the TV and target your specific ad to them. You know, and it may not be the same ad that goes to all those people. You may want to find, you know, people who watch Rachel Maddow, and you also might have other information about them that, you know, through their phones that they visited a Whole Foods, and those are the people you want to target, and they get a different, you know, message than people who watch Rachel Maddow and visited, you know, some other store.
Now, a little later in the program, we'll talk about why some people think this is a great tool to reach potential voters. But Evan, in your reporting, you also put forth an example of how, you know, just outside the world of political campaigns, we've seen this technology be put to use in some very controversial fields. For example, I mean, you talk about how anti-abortion groups use this kind of technology to track women who were entering waiting rooms of clinics where abortions were provided in some cities, and then they were tracking their phones and pushing ads to them about alternatives to abortion.
That's exactly right. It was a so-called pregnancy crisis center, and they teamed up with an ad company or a targeting company in Massachusetts, in Boston, and they basically built digital fences around abortion clinics in 12 cities across the country. You know, New York was one of them. They were all over the country, and what they did was if you walked into this fence, and the fences were inside the waiting rooms of these abortion clinics or right outside them, ads would pop up offering you alternatives to abortion. And then the ads would keep popping up for 30 days. Now, this was a case where regulators in Massachusetts, because the company was there, they said that they had some jurisdiction and they invoked a consumer protection law and reached an agreement with the company. There were no penalties or fines paid, as far as I understand it. And the company agreed to stop doing this. But in most cases, that kind of crackdown just isn't happening because the laws around this are so vague.
Right. Okay. So that, I mean, that's a perfect example of how I imagine in the coming months and years, we're going to see a lot of other sectors adopt this kind of technology. But regarding political campaigns, I mean, Evan, we're talking about domestic, legitimate political campaigns here. So, you know, what are people saying are the potential upsides to this? I mean, it's a brand new way to reach potential voters. So what's wrong with it?
you know, that you'll hear that a lot from the political campaigns. They say, look, this is, you know, we're not really invading anyone's privacy because there's this sort of firewall where even though we have all this data, it's anonymous and we can't match it with your exact address, or we're not even doing that. We're not matching it to the person or the phone number. We're just targeting these groups of people. And, you know, they say this is about messaging, and you want to get the right message to the people it'll be most effective with. And why not target you with a message that's relevant to your life?
Well, I think I can think of a couple of reasons here, but it just because it feels very invasive, though, right? I mean, if all you have to do is you don't even have to go to, I mean, according to your reporting, you don't even have to go to a political rally, for example, that if a campaign like picks a zip code or a particular building in a zip code and they say, we want to geofence everyone in that building, they can just do that and then start pushing ads to you by virtue of you having passed through that space.
That's right. And not only that, I mean, they can go back 3 months, 6 months and say, we want everyone who, you know, went into this building at this particular time and they can get you in that geofence and then use it to target you. So, you know, what's interesting in talking to the people who do this is, you know, they don't seem to have a problem with it or see major privacy concerns, but they also acknowledge that in a lot of cases, people have no idea that this is happening to them. And this is, you know, this is something that people are stepping into these geofences, having no idea they're stepping into the geofences and then getting targeted.
Well, I mean, and also thereby inadvertently creating almost an airtight information bubble around them, depending on who's targeting them. So we're going to talk about whether or not that's good for democracy overall when we come back. Evan Halper, stand by for a moment. Evan Halper, staff writer covering politics for the Los Angeles Times. He's written extensively about the new world of campaign tech. And this is technology that domestic campaigns are using to track you, to follow you, to learn all about you, to send you targeted political ads and content. And if domestic campaigns can do it, what's stopping a foreign power from doing so too? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about campaign tech and the ever invasive and pervasive ways that political campaigns can target your devices, whether it's your smartphone, your television, your laptop, and send you very specifically tailored political content, whether you want it or not. We're joined today by Evan Halper. He's staff writer covering politics for the Los Angeles Times. He's written about this, and we have a link to Evan's reporting at onpointradio.org. And let's listen to how the parties themselves or partisans talk about this campaign tech. You're about to hear a little bit of tape from Tech for Campaigns. They're an organization that brings together volunteers from the tech sector to help, in this case, Democratic candidates in local elections around the country. Here's an excerpt from their presentation video.
Tech for Campaigns is the digital engine for centrist and progressive campaigns. We're building both tech infrastructure and pairing that with the best technical and digital talent out there to implement on non-presidential campaigns.
When you look at how Democrats spend their money on campaign tactics, the vast majority is still on TV and direct mail. What we can really do is help local candidates learn how to reach voters where they spend the vast majority of their time these days, which is online.
That's an ad for a group called Tech for Campaigns. Evan Halper, let me turn back to you briefly here for just a couple more quick questions about this. Because, you know, what was it back in 2008 and 2012? Lots of political observers were lauding the Obama campaign for really being the first digitally savvy presidential campaign. And so now, since things are getting more sophisticated, has the shine worn off on this? And because both parties are doing it?
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think the way people perceive this is changing, and what you can do now is so much more extensive than what you could do even in 2008, that it's giving some campaigns pause about how far do you push this. It's interesting you're running the Tech for Campaigns clip, because I know folks over there are sort of grappling with, okay, when is it appropriate to use a geofence and when is it not appropriate? And there is this feeling that, you know, if you go so far, in some cases, candidates have been known to geofence areas right around the polling stations, and then target ads like as people are waiting in line to vote, which seems like you're just pushing a boundary too far. So we've reached this moment, and we saw what happened in the last election cycle with this firm, Cambridge Analytica. It became a whole scandal where, you know, Facebook was sharing data with them, and they were creating psychographic, what they called them, profiles of every voter, and using data in a way that raised a lot of questions about, okay, where are the boundaries and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And a lot of campaigns are now grappling with, they have these tools and they can do these things that to really persuade and even manipulate people, but how far should they push it?
Right. So, Evan, hang on here for just a second. Let's bring in Shane Greer. Joins us from Washington. Shane is co-owner and co-publisher of the trade journal Campaigns and Elections. Shane Greer, welcome to you.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about how you see the sort of the creep or the growth of campaign tech as a factor in elections. Is this a positive thing, or do you have concerns?
So what I think is really interesting about this, you know, Campaigns and Elections has been around since 1980, and we operate in all the kind of major political campaign markets, you know, primarily the U.S., Latin America, and Europe. And what we see in each of these is radically different regulatory environments, right? And as we've seen this explosion, and I use that word advisedly because really it has been an explosion of digital strategy tactics, campaign technology over the last few years, which has transformed how campaigns are run. It's transformed how campaigns communicate, and it transformed how voters, donors, and so on are engaged with. And the manner in which that engagement takes place is in large part a reflection of the regulatory, you know, environment. When I came here to NPR headquarters today, and I was in, you know, I'm in the car. I knew when the light turned red that the car would stop and the other cars would go. I knew which side of the road we were on because, you know, there was a clear regulatory operating environment. And, you know, if you compare, say, Europe, and particularly I think here of countries like Germany and Austria and so on, we have a very tight regulatory environment and very huge control over what campaigns can do versus the U.S., which is much more of a free-for-all. You know, I don't think we should be surprised that, you know, the breadth of what campaigns can do and are able to do and do is huge.
So we'll talk more about the differences in the regulatory environment in a moment here. But just humor me for a second, Shane. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that there could be – that there's an advantage for democracy in this kind of technology? Because you know, broadly speaking, tech is always – the tech utopians say it's a democratizing force. So could the access that campaign tech gives to, say, less well-funded candidates be something that you know they didn't have before, and therefore levels the playing field in an election?
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about a couple of things there. You talked about down-ballot campaigns, right? Digital's great for down-ballot campaigns because it's, in many cases, cheaper to do, certainly cheaper to do than run television advertising in a major market, right? So there is a democratizing force there. I also think one thing, you know, that is important to note about digital, because of the kind of targeting we see, and this isn't just campaigns, this is the consumer sector as well. I mean, Evan, towards the end of his article, you know, mentions he has someone quoted saying, you know, it could be someone trying to sell you a Volvo. You know, anyone who's engaging with consumers or voters is doing this kind of thing. And what it does allow them to do, and I think there is a net benefit in this aspect, is deliver the most targeted and relevant ads possible. So you are seeing content that's much more relevant to you, that you're more likely to engage with. It's also, because of the targetability, one would assume that it's doing a better job if you're a down-ballot candidate of getting your message in front of individuals who are perhaps more likely to be receptive of it, and but for that engagement, would not be aware of your candidacy, or fewer of them would be aware of your candidacy. So I think there's clearly huge benefits to this in the sense of, you know, how you can get your message in front of people, making sure it's relevant and so on. But there are downsides as well. And I think the one thing that the U.S. Hasn't really wrestled with is where is that line?
Right. Well, so the thing is, though, that when we have the power to send increasingly refined content and political advertising to people based on, you know, things like where they shop, right, or what sports teams they give a thumbs up to on their Facebook posts. I mean, these are reinforcing messages.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And let me take that a step further. I mean, here's one thing that I think we, you know, should be concerned about. It used to be, let's go back to the Bill Clinton, the first Bill Clinton campaigns, the first sort of 24-hour news cycle campaigns. In that environment, you still had to put out broad spectrum communication. If you were delivering a video ad, it was through television, and not only was it the case that everyone in a targeted household saw that ad, their neighbor saw it, their colleagues saw it, everyone saw the same ad. So everyone had the same kind of frame of reference around the debate that was going on about that particular campaign. Now, of course, because of the targetability, not only is it the case that I am almost certainly seeing an entirely different ad than my neighbor, I may be seeing completely different ads than people within my own household. And there we have a problem, I think, because just as with social media bubbles, where the environment that we as individuals operate in tends more and more to reflect the biases that we have, good or bad, and therefore our view of the world changes to the extent that the world we see is more like the world we want to see, even if it isn't really the world as it is. But here you have a situation because of the targetability, and you're seeing different ads that the ad I'm seeing may be suggesting something completely different to an ad that you're seeing from a different candidate, and we're not able to have a meaningful democratic discussion. And in any democracy, what's required is an informed populace that ultimately is getting the same kind of information. I think that's where there is a real concern. Yeah, targeting is fantastic. Seeing relevant ads is fantastic. But democracy is also a debate, and we can only have a meaningful debate if we're having a debate on the same terms and we all have the same information. And with targetability, that is less.
Well, exactly. So, Evan Halper, let me turn back to you on that. I mean, we can only have a debate if we have access to those disparate viewpoints and varieties of information. But if we don't even know it's out there because it's hard to access it, because we're getting targeted with purely customized pieces of advertising, I mean, isn't that fundamentally dangerous to how we presume our democracy ought to operate? Do the campaigns even think about it when they're engaging with this technology?
No, I don't think the campaigns are thinking about that very important point. I think they're thinking about, you know, how can we persuade every possible voter that we can? And, you know, this raises an important question about what these, you know, the fallout from some of these technologies. And because this micro-targeting, you know, has so many unintended effects, you know, you have a trade group in the UK of advertising folks who have suggested there should be a ban on micro-targeting, which is really interesting. Because, you know, you just don't know. So many things are happening and it's moving so fast, as Shane said, that it's just having, you know, an effect on people who are being manipulated in ways they don't realize. And it's ultimately having an effect on democracy.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to David, who's calling from Williamsville, New York. David, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm not sure I can even be micro-targeted, and let me explain why. I'm blind. I've never owned even a cell phone, much less a smartphone. I've never interacted with the Internet, but I do interact with my smart TV, just network-type stuff, and I do interact with a smart speaker. So I'm genuinely curious, can they even find me if I, because I'm blind, because I can't even see a pop-up ad on my TV?
All right. Well, David, thank you for your call. Evan Halper, do you have an answer for him?
You know, if you don't have a phone and you're not using the Internet, there's a good chance you may be escaping all this. Although your question about an Alexa or a device like that and whether that's used, I actually do not know the answer.
Yeah,
whether that...
if I could actually just
ahead,
come in on that,
yeah.
Evan, because I agree with Evan overall on the smart speaker. What's really interesting here, you know, this is an evolving technology. It's transforming how search is done, but it's still very early in terms of, you know, how you use it to engage with people. One thing that's interesting here we do know is, of course, Amazon got a patent, I think, a year or two ago, which essentially was around sentiment, right? So you're not listening to the specific words that are being said, but you're taking tonality and being able to say at a very basic level, this person is happy or this person is sad, right? Well, if you're able to target against that kind of data, that could be very powerful. So there's this comes back to this open-ended thing we started with, which is one thing I think that hasn't really happened in the U.S. is a discussion around where are the lines and what should the regulatory environment look like. And with a technology like that, you know, you ultimately could be extremely well targeted because right. It's literally listening to everything you're saying, even if it's buffering and dumping the whole time. Yeah. You know, there are still things that could be done technologically that are not at the moment, but they will or won't be depending on the regulatory environment that's created.
Yeah. So David, I think the answer to your question is, as Shane just said, is if it's not being done now, it probably will be in the very near future. Shane and Evan, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation Stephanie Hanke. She's joining us from San Francisco. She's co-founder and executive director of the Tactical Technology Collective, a Berlin-based nonprofit focused on technology, human rights, and civil liberties. And Stephanie Hanke happened to be in Silicon Valley this weekend meeting with companies involved in campaign tech. Stephanie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magda.
So, you know, we've been talking about, you know, what's being done here in the United States and the regulatory environment around it. But I was wondering if you might actually help give us a bit more of a global perspective. How much is this technology being used in elections internationally?
It's increasingly being used in elections internationally. One of the things that we've seen just at the same rate as technologies over the last 5 to 7 years been used more and more in the United States. We've seen that increasingly also, not only in Europe, but also in different parts of the world. And I think people have seen that very much in the news recently. I'm English, actually. You probably hear from my accent. But in the Brexit context, for example, the referendum we had there, these kinds of techniques were used intensively. And I think what we're seeing increasingly is technologies, but also political strategies being used in the US, now being used increasingly in other countries. So it's kind of a precedent setter in that sense.
Okay, but Shane was talking a little bit earlier about how the regulatory environment is quite different from nation to nation. So when you look around the world, is there a place that you say is doing it right? It's finding a balance between campaigns being allowed to use technology, but not interfering with the democratic process?
Yeah, I think the regulatory environment does really impact what can be done. But I think we're finding that even in countries where people would expect the environment to be different, both in terms of the way that elections are run, but also the way that privacy, for example, and data collection works, I think even in those countries, what we're finding is that the regulators are really struggling just to understand even what's happening. And because it's such a fast-moving and sort of new set of questions that they're facing, they're usually looking at regulation after it's already happened. So again, in the case of in the UK and Brexit, they're now looking and sort of trying to undo and unpick what happened. But essentially, it's too late. And so they're trying to sort of catch up with the questions in front of them. And the questions are so big, it's very difficult, especially because the main advice they have on technology is from the technology companies themselves. Which we saw last year, you know, Facebook and so on being the main advisors. This is not, you know, they've obviously got a different view on it. So sometimes I would say the regulators don't even really know what questions to ask.
Could I just come in on that point? Because one thing that's really interesting on that's happening in the U.S., because there has been a lack of federal regulation, you're seeing more states step up and take regulatory action, Maryland being one example of this. But there is a problem with that. If you have a patchwork system of regulation, a patchwork system of regulation in a market as large as the U.S. means that really only the very largest companies are able to avail themselves fully of that marketplace because they can afford the lawyers, the developers, and so on to ensure that they are fully in compliance. If you're a startup or a smaller marketing technology shop, it's a lot more difficult for you to operate in a patchwork environment. So there is one of the things that's interesting in the U.S. context is the state level regulation on, you know, some folks look at it and say, great, you know, states are taking action, but ultimately to the benefit of the largest organizations.
And Stephanie, do you have a comment on that?
I think that the small technology companies and the small data brokers, it is difficult for them to navigate the space. And I totally understand there's a big difference between that and the platforms that have the resources. But I still think that they're able to operate in an environment where, just coming back to some of the earlier conversation, I think it's important to remember that this is technology that is developed mostly by the commercial sector, mostly in the context of commercial technologies.
Right.
And therefore, it's just being kind of extended and applied to a new set of clients. So I think it's tempting to sort of think of this special industry with small startups and so on, which sometimes is the case, of course. But at the same time, I think we need to think about it in terms of the broader perspective. So meaning that if it's normal for people to be, some of those examples you heard earlier, for example, geofencing and so on, this is technology that was developed for other things. And so I think if it's normal for that to be used, it can easily be applied to the political and sphere.
The point being that if it's developed for the commercial sector to sell, shoes or soap, people aren't necessarily thinking about the ethical implications of it when they dump it into the political sector.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Well, stand by, Stephanie and Shane and Evan. We will take a quick break here. We're talking about campaign tech and how technology is making it easier than ever for campaigns to access you and to target you with very personalized ads and content, and what that might mean for elections and democracy. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about campaign tech and the ever-increasing ways that political campaigns have access to you through your digital devices. Now, one of the most infamous examples, of course, we mentioned it a little earlier in the hour, was Cambridge Analytica. Here's the former CEO of that company, Alexander Nix, in a 2015 video. Okay, this is before all of their activities vis-a-vis harvesting Facebook profiles came out. But in 2015, Nix explained how detailed data gives political strategists an edge in campaigns.
In the simplest form, the more you know about someone, the more you can align a campaign with their requirements or their wants and needs. Mm. So at a very basic level, we try and take a really very vast quantity of demographic, consumer, and lifestyle data, and we blend that with psychographic data, which is a modeling of personality, to start to be able to target and communicate with people about the things that they really, really care about.
That's the former CEO of Cambridge Analytica, Alexander Nix, in 2015. Stephanie Hanke, let me turn back to you here, because you did mention Brexit and Cambridge Analytica, but you're in San Francisco today and have been visiting with Silicon Valley companies who are involved in campaign tech. Do you find them open to conversations about the ethical implications of their work? Is it something that they're even willing to think about as they continue to develop these technologies?
I think they're more willing than they were previously, and I actually think there's a change. The environment's changing overall, and after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is almost a year ago now, I think users have got more nervous, companies have got more nervous, not just in the political sphere, but in general, about the idea that maybe not everybody's happy with this kind of dynamic. And I think what we've seen is that some of the smaller companies actually wanting to come out and be clearer about what they're doing, precisely because they don't want to be mistaken for an organization like Cambridge Analytica. I mean, there are hundreds of companies doing this kind of work. We've all obviously had our eyes on one, but I think that there are many, many different companies, not only in the US and Europe, but also in Latin America and Asia and so on, all doing this work, and some of them coming out very clearly and trying to differentiate themselves from that and saying, no, what we're doing is legitimate. But also, obviously, we've talked mostly in this show so far about the small companies, but obviously the large platforms are also extremely influential in this space. Google, Facebook, WhatsApp, YouTube, and so on, in different ways. providing these services on a massive scale. And I think once you go outside of the US as well, those companies are extremely important in that context. And I do think that they are willing to engage in a conversation about these issues. But I think the enormity of the problem once you start looking at elections in countries like India or Indonesia, which are happening this year, or Brazil recently, you know, the enormity of the problem for them is quite difficult to deal with, I think.
Right. So, Evan Helper, let me bring you back in the conversation here. You heard Stephanie a little earlier in the show saying that some, you know, lawmakers or regulators don't even know the right questions to ask around the emergence of this technology here. Is that something that you found or has the appetite in Washington changed to sort of really take to look at this problem more head on?
No, I've absolutely found that knowing what questions to ask and understanding the scope of the problem and listening to people other than, as Stephanie said before, the big tech companies who are the ones they're getting advice from and have a vested interest in not seeing too much regulation here, it's a big problem. I mean, even in California, where they passed a very sweeping privacy law, I was trying to get a read from regulators for when that law takes effect in 2020. So how does this campaign tech apply? And will you require disclosure for some of these apps that are giving up, you know, all this location data about you? And they couldn't answer it. It was something that they were, you know, not really certain of and trying to figure out. And, you know, they're always sort of a few steps behind the tech companies on this stuff. And then you also have the complicating problem of some of these politicians who are the regulators and who are passing these laws. You know, they like this technology. It's good for their campaigns. They're using it. And so right. there's a reluctance there also.
Right. And Stephanie, I'm going to go back to the college here in just a second, but one more quick question for you about what's done in other countries here, because, you know, while we may be struggling with this new world of technology and campaigns here, as you said a little earlier, I'm not sure I heard you say that there's another nation out there that's doing it very well. Like, do I have this right that, say, for example, in the United Kingdom, if you break election laws there, there's a maximum fine that's what amounts to, what, £20,000 or so?
Yeah, I think that what happens in the UK right now is, if after the fact you're found to be breaking the election rules around, for example, spending, then there's a fine. But then that fine is a maximum right now of £20,000 in that context, which is, you know, about $25,000 to $30,000. And in that context, it's really not a disincentive for especially in the case of Brexit. It was a referendum. It's a one-time vote. It's not necessarily an ongoing party political interest in the same way that it might be with an election. So then you get a lot of different entities just kind of going for it, basically, and being in a situation where they don't really care about the consequences as much later as you might do. And I think that's one of the things that we see here with this technology, and also some examples earlier. There's an assumption that political parties want ongoing trust of the voters and really care about the fact that they look, you know, consistent and they have the right message continuously. And of course, what we've seen recently in different political contexts is less and less care about the problem of image or ongoing credibility or trust. So then in that case, sort of the gloves are off and much more different things can happen, worrying little less about reputation.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Vincent, who's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Vincent, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to make a quick comment that I think that digital privacy here in America should be becoming and is becoming one of the more important issues. And if I find out that a candidate is targeting me through these digital means, I'm less inclined to vote for them.
Okay, so potentially backfires there with you. Vincent, thank you so much. Let's go to Ted, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Ted, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a two-point question. One is there any legislation being written to make the public aware that they're getting ready to walk into or approaching a GeoNet area? And my second question is, if my phone is off, am I still subject to being targeted with this GeoNet advertising?
All right, Ted, thank you so much for your call. Shane Greer, let's take the second one first, because we've got some questions actually coming in online exactly the same. People want to know, can you just turn your phone off and be immune from
the geofence? I'm not a technologist. I think as long as the campaign isn't the NSA, if your phone's off, you're probably good. But the first part of his question raised a really interesting point, which is, is there legislation on the cards to inform people if they're walking into a geofence? Not that I'm aware of, but that actually does speak to the key issue here, right? Which is informed consent around this issue, because there's no legal issue here. the vast majority of folks in engaging in this kind of activity are absolutely behaving within the confines of the law. The question, though, is the consumer informed? You know, do you know when you sign up to Facebook exactly how your information is being used? And it's not enough to present someone with, you know, 20, 30, 40, 100 pages of privacy terms. You know, really, I think it needs to be something where it's quite simple, like when you sign up for this here in basic English is how your data might be used. Because ultimately, you know, campaigns are there to do one thing, and they do it very well. And, you know, again, as the industry publication CNE, I have to say that, you know, when we're hosting our events and stuff, ethics is something that comes up a lot, and it's something that the industry really heavily engages in and values. But ultimately, campaigns are there to win, and they're there to operate within the confines of the, you know, the regulatory system that they're in, whether that's in the US or the UK or Germany or wherever it is. So to the extent that that change may be desired or needed or otherwise, you know, that is one for the regulators themselves.
Well, Evan Helper, I still want to know if either you or Stefan, do you have an answer to the turning your phone off question? Is that, Evan, is that good enough to avoid the geofence?
If you turn your phone off, that's going to go a very long way in avoiding the geofence. I mean, you know, these other tracking technologies, like through your smart TV, like we talked about before, or your laptop. But turning your phone off, I think, you know, of course, once you turn your phone off, it's hard to function in today's society with your phone off all the time. So that's a tough option, but it would keep you immune from these fences.
So Stephanie Hanke, on that point, though, I mean, Shane was talking earlier about, like, it's just unrealistic for people to go through dozens and dozens of pages of terms of service to figure out what they assent to or not. I mean, is that also just kind of not even an issue in this day and age? Because I think I've had previous conversations with folks who say just the sheer act of downloading an app constitutes agreement for a lot of the terms of service before you even open the app. It might, you know, it might just be active on your phone from the moment you download it. So what's the point of even asking people to look at the terms of service?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that we can have informed consent in this environment when even the people sometimes developing, you know, sometimes using the technology or paying for it, like, for example, the political parties aren't really even sure how it works sometimes. So obviously there needs to be something there for the voter to sort of feel like they can go and find those things out if they want. But we also have to be really aware of this, or wary of this idea of the overwhelmed user, that, you know, it's all about you and you can agree and you can choose and you can consent, but it's completely overwhelming what it is you're agreeing to. And it's completely opaque how it works behind the scenes as well. I think that one of the things that in our research that we've been thinking about at Tactical Tech is looking at the question of how does this not only work in terms of influence, which is what we've been talking about, sort of advertising and targeting, but also how does data become an asset, and how is data, personal data, also used in the context of intelligence gathering for political campaigns?
Right.
And there's a lot going on that we haven't talked about. You know, when we focus on the advert, which is important, we're really just thinking about one aspect of the whole scene. You're thinking about other techniques that are used, like digital listening, like, for example, which is, you know, looking at what people are talking about online with their political positions, or mass testing of messaging to get that. You know, when you combine that with targeting and you try thousands of different adverts on different people, which is also targeted, then it becomes much more powerful. And these are the kinds of things we can't consent to.
So, Stephanie, these data brokers who are, you know, one of the groups in the middle of all of this, do they care who they sell to? Because I guess what I'm trying to ask is there anything stopping a foreign power from doing these exact same techniques that the political campaigns are using?
I think that there are many different types of companies working in these areas. Some of them are agnostic, you know, they're really just selling regardless, and it's just a client. That's how they see it. Others are aligned actually with different, you know, left or right positions, let's say, on the political spectrum, and will only work within that space. And then others are sort of very involved with maybe a particular party or a particular way of doing things. So I think that and then when you look at, of course, the big platforms, they're open for anyone to buy. Mm. And I think that that's one of the things we've seen in different countries, where you have a much more varied political party system with a lot of different kinds of parties that can both have that democratizing force that we talked about earlier, a sort of equalizing force. It makes it accessible. But it can also mean that essentially the more money you have, the more power you have in that space. And that's really important in terms of things like business investment and political processes.
Right. Well, let's take one more call here. Let's go to Ryan, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm kind of dubious about the efficacy of these advertisements in the first place. I mean, I'm 27, and honestly, I see a lot of people my generation kind of disregarding advertisements. You know, we know what we like. We know what we don't want. And so I think at that point, the ads are really just more of means of conveyance of information as opposed to kind of swaying you one way or the other?
If I can just come in on that, it's a great question. And actually, there was a study very recently conducted in Texas, I think, which looked at millennials and influence around programmatic advertising, so display advertising that you see as you're traveling around the web. And what that study demonstrated was that actually it can have a measurable positive impact on turnout with this particular millennial cohort. So there is no question that, you know, ads have some kind of influence, whether that's about conversion, clicking to do something, call to action, and that's measurable and demonstrable. And there's a very good reason why campaigns and consumer, you know, people selling Volvos and everything else continue to do that. There is a broader question around, you know, can you actually measure influence? And, you know, is this ad persuading you? There is less, there is much less behind that in terms of studies and so on. But there's no question that, you know, that I think to the question that was asked, it's an anecdotal point. Like, I'm not really influenced by it. Well, maybe you wouldn't know if you were, but there are studies that show that, yeah, these ads actually do have a measurable impact in terms of converting people to take an action, a specific call to action, less around persuasion.
Interesting. And Shane, just as an additional thought on that, is there any regulation that says that like some conventional political advertising, that there has to be an identification of who's sending the ad? It doesn't necessarily have to be like this, you know, this is an ad from campaign X, does it?
Yeah, well, there's been a huge amount of discussion around that, because obviously the traditional, you know, I'm X and I approve this ad that works in the 30-second TV format just isn't right for the digital age. I mean, if we consider snackable ads, and snackable ads are ads of 6 seconds, video ads of 6 seconds or less, clearly by the time you said that, the ad is already done. So that's an evolving environment. We've seen sort of some self-regulation with, you know, Facebook's database of political ads, and if you're putting out an ad there that is deemed to be political, it has to be clear, you know, who is paying for it. But that space is an evolving one, and again, it goes back to this point about ensuring people that are informed. And the one thing I would say here is that the industry is very focused on operating within the regulatory environment and doing its best to help campaigns win by putting relevant messages in front of voters. But to the extent that, again, change is desired, and the extent that there's a discussion to be had, and I think there clearly is a discussion to be had in the U.S. simply because there hasn't really been one, that's ultimately a question for regulators. And while the answer is being given in some cases at a state level, it is resolutely not being given at a federal level.
Right. So, Evan Halper, we've just got about a minute left to go here. Mm-hmm. You know, Shane just mentioned Facebook saying, like, we'll build a catalog, a database. I mean, is that even a realistic beginning of a solution, given that we're talking about a world where people could be pelted with tens of thousands of individually targeted ads?
You know, it's something, and more transparency is always good, but, you know, that's obviously not a solution. It requires something much more broader in scope, and you know, we're just not even starting the conversation here. So it needs to go a lot further than that. If people really want to know what's going on and have options for opting out, and just be aware of all that's happening.
Well, Evan Halper, staff writer covering politics for the Los Angeles Times, his recent story titled "Your Phone and TV Are Tracking You and Political Campaigns Are Listening In." We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Evan Halper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Stephanie Hanke, co-founder and executive director of the Tactical Technology Collective, a Berlin-based nonprofit focused on technology, human rights, and civil liberties. Thank you so very much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
And Shane Greer, co-owner and co-publisher of the trade journal Campaigns and Elections. Shane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, by the way, starting next week, we're going to be broadcasting a special series every Monday that we're calling Where We Call Home. We'll be touching down in communities across the country to discuss things like affordable housing, home ownership, small town living, and more. So go to OnPort Radio to take a special series survey and share your experience with things like working from home, the rising cost of living, and whether you actually know who your neighbors are and more. That's at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.